everyone who's joining us right now on our live stream. We appreciate you tuning in, or anybody who might be watching this after the fact. We're going to get started here shortly. I did want to just open one file, if I can find it quick enough. Okay, there it is. All right, so if you're joining us online and you want to follow along, go to gracelifebiblechurch.com, scroll down under recent sermons, and click on the link for November 10, lesson 244, and then you can click on that link, and then that'll open up the notes that we're going to be following along here in class. Those of you guys that are here in person, there are notes on the back table if you haven't already picked those up. So, since we are getting started late, let's get rolling. The notes are thick today. A lot of it's pictures and images of stuff that I tried to include, but we'll just sort of see how far we get and go from there. Okay. So, lesson 244, assessing the printed history of the King James text. And what I want to do in this lesson is I want to try to bring things up through 1660. Okay. So, let's look at the introduction. In lesson 243, we wrapped up our discussion of William Kilburn's circa 1660 piece, Dangerous Errors in Several Late Printed Bibles to the Great Scandal and Corruption of Sound and True Religion. In doing so, we noted the following conclusions from Kilburn's work. So I've repeated this here as the introduction. So this is what we sort of said in conclusion regarding Kilburn. Number one, based on the evidence furnished in his pamphlet outlining, quote, gross errors in the printings of the AV and the warning found in Revelation 22, 18 through 19, action needs to be taken to rectify the situation. So as you guys recall, did Kilburn identify a host of different printing errors in the King James editions between 1631 and 1660? Okay. Number two, he prays that God move the King's divine majesty and parliament to act on behalf of the Commonwealth of England to ensure the printing of the scriptures in their proper dialect, speech, and idiom. And those are his terms from Dangerous Errors. Thirdly, does not want the scriptures to be carelessly and erroneously printed to the private advancement of certain parties. So I skipped the fancy word. So he does not want private parties to be advancing things in a careless and erroneous way, as had been being done under the Commonwealth period under Cromwell. Four, Kilburn does not want the future printing of Bibles to be, quote, solely appropriated to Mr. Hill and Mr. Field, appointed under Cromwell, who are trying to assert private right or ownership of the original manuscript of the King James translators. Five, the state should not be divested of the patronage and protection of the Word of God. Six, Bible printing should not be left again to those outside of the oversight of the Stationer's Company. Seven, only competent master printers should be permitted to print the text under the oversight of Parliament, most notably London and Cambridge. And eight, no private printing rights should be allowed in the AV. So, Kilburn, after assessing the situation and providing 10 different editions as evidence, these are sort of his conclusions of what should happen. And it's important that we understand that he's writing this right around the time when the restoration of the monarchy is going to be occurring. You guys remember your English history. There's a civil war period where the king is kicked off the throne, and there's infighting between the Puritan faction and the Royalist faction. And for a while, Cromwell went, the Puritans went out for a while, and they established a commonwealth with Cromwell sort of as the leadership. And in that period, it's sort of a free-for-all as far as the printed history of the text is concerned. And so Kilburn is endeavoring to try to rectify that through the writing of this piece in circa 1660. Okay, bottom of page one. In addition, we also commented on some of the practical takeaways from having studied Kilburn's work. And again, I'm summarizing here. Number one, true printer's errors are easy to spot when compared to the standard received AV text because they are almost always wacky and obvious. Did we not see that where big sections are left out or some sort of crazy reading is, you know, identified, okay? In contrast, editorial changes are measured and generally serve to improve the text. So that's a distinction between an editorial change and a printer's error. Most of the textual differences in the printed history of text are clearly the result of printer errors. Number two, editorial changes and printer's errors are both realities when studying the printed history of the King James text. Studying Kilburn's dangerous errors highlights the reality that printer's errors... Why did I have this in here twice? Studying Kilburn's dangerous errors highlights the reality that printer's errors are generally easy to spot because they clearly lead to nonsense readings. When a printer's error is not obvious, so for example, when you leave not out of the seventh commandment and say, thou shalt commit adultery, is that an obvious printer error? Okay? So when a printer's error is not obvious, honest inquiry is open to the possibility that an editorial change has occurred. In the current lesson, we want to offer some final thoughts on the totality of Kilburn's work, as well as to discern the state of the text by the restoration of the monarchy in 1660. Okay? So, anybody have any comments or questions about the introduction before we move on? Nope. All right. So, my first main point then is final thoughts on Kilburn's work. Prior to the publication of Dangerous Errors by Kilburn, an advertisement was printed in circa 1660 in the Wednesday, October 29 to Thursday, November 6, 1656 edition of Mercurius Politicus periodical. Okay? Now again, that is this periodical right here. Okay? Mercurius Politicus. It's a editorial piece, and you can see the dates here, Wednesday, October 29 to Thursday, November 6, 1656. And so at the end of this, there is the advertisement that I showed you guys last time regarding the Bible, and that regarding the printing of the Bible. And I'm going to find that page here, and it's at the bottom of this page right here, starting with the statement there in advertisement. Okay? Let's go back to the notes. So, I'm on page 2. This advertisement purported to be publishing a text that had been, quote, examined, corrected, and amended according to the original manuscript copy of the translators. All right? So, that language, again, is right here. All right? Here it is. To be examined, corrected, and amended according to the original manuscript of the translators. So whoever took out this advertisement, are they claiming that they have the original manuscript of the King James translators and that they have examined, corrected, and amended the text according to this manuscript? Okay? Now we did touch on this a little bit last week, but there's a few more things we need to say about it. Professor David Norton states the following regarding this advertisement in A Textual History of the King James Bible. Quote, the same advertisement that vaunted Field and Hill's possession of the translator's original also made much of their effort to set a standard by His Highness's printers as they styled themselves under Cromwell. So in other words, they have rights to print under Cromwell, but they are sort of calling themselves His Highness's printers. And Kilburn obviously has an issue with that because Cromwell is technically not a what? King, okay? In a grand example of the pot calling the kettle black, Field and Hills observe that, quote, for the space of about 12 years past, the printing of the Bible lay in common. So in other words, anyone could what? With the result, quote, that many hundreds of very gross errors are escaped in the common impressions now abroad to the great scandal of religion and government and abuse of the people. Now, let's stop here. This is Hills and Fields saying this. Field and Hills, right?
Yeah.
What did I say the first time?
Yeah.
Did I say it right? Okay. The new edition to be sold at the house of Henry Hills in Ulstergate Street, next door to the sign with the peacock, remedies this situation. Okay? Now that is a reference down here, all the way at the bottom of the advertisement. Okay? Is now sold at the house of Henry Hills in Aldersgate Street, next to the door of the sign of the peacock. So in other words, if you want this revised Bible, where do you need to go to get it?
There.
to this establishment here. It's telling you what street it's on and where to, you know, where to find it, right? And they're claiming that this one is the one that is examined, corrected, and amended according to the original master copy of the translators. Okay. So, due care hath been had to settle the printing of the scriptures. So this is from the advertisement. Okay. Due care hath been set to settle the printing of the Holy Scriptures in an orderly way for the time to come. And there is now a Bible finished by His Highnesses, and he's talking about Cromwell's, because it's 1656, okay, special command, free from those errors which are kept in many other impressions, it being examined, corrected, and amended according to the original manuscript of the translators. So again, guys, that is this paragraph right here. For remedy whereof due care hath been had in the settle of the printing of the Holy Scriptures. And so they're claiming that they've examined, corrected, and amended this according to the original copy of the translators. Look at the next paragraph. At the end, that a book of so sacred concernment may be exactly and truly printed for the future, there are two correctors kept to correct all Bibles that shall be printed hereafter. And over and above, there is also learned persons appointed by His Highness carefully to revise every sheet before it be wrought off the press. So, let's just stop there. What are they claiming? Are they claiming to have the best copies, the most accurate copies, corrected by the translator's original manuscript with due care, and are they saying these are the best ones you can buy as far as their accuracy? In the advertisement. Is everybody with me? As we saw in lesson 243, Kilburn's dangerous errors puts the lie to the claims made in the advertisement from 1656. This edition constitutes one of Kilburn's most lengthy discussions. So I have reduplicated it for you on the top of page 3. Now we're not going to look at every word of this because we already did this last week. But just a couple things to remind you. Okay, look, we will look at the first paragraph. So, understand what's going on here. Kilburn, in circa 1660, one of the ones that he is reviewing is the one by Field and Hills that is being advertised in this advertisement as the best copy. And he finds all of these errors in it that we're about ready to just sort of peruse through. Look at top of page 3. In a Bible in 12, that's duodecimo size, printed at London by Hen Hills and J. Field in anno 1656, corrected by one Mr. Robinson, a Scottish rabbi, and published in an advertisement by Mercurius Politicus, 6 November 1656. So which edition is Kilburn talking about? Which edition is Kilburn talking about? He's talking about the one from this what?
Advertisement.
The one that's claiming to be what?
Error-free.
And corrected, amended, etc. by the translator's original copy. Okay? And then notice what he says. He says, and in truth, I think he was not deceived, though indeed he abused the commonwealth, for I am confident if the number of the impressions, as I am informed, 20,000, there are as many great faults therein, verbal, literal, and in the difference of the italic words, to the great corruption of the text, and in false points of distinction, so that besides the base paper, meaning what? Inferior quality, right? The base paper and printing and abridgment, and perversion of the contents, and transposing and confounding of words, whereby it is very troublesome to read, it is the worst of all the rest that are exposed in your view. So in Kilburn's judgment, this, the one that is advertised here, is the worst one he what? He looked at. Okay? So the one that's claiming to be examined, corrected, and amended by the original manuscript, he says it's the worst one he's looked at. Okay? Let's see. As appeared palpably to the Parliament, whereby the sale thereof was inhibited, but since dispersed very much at county fairs and markets by bookbinders and petty chapmen, being so fitting book for the being no fitting book for the sale by the stationers in London, wherein you may observe these faults. And then he's going to list all the, not all of them, but a bunch of the faults that he finds. Okay? So Kilburn is saying that the one that is publishing this advertisement, the edition that this advertisement is advertising as being the best, this advertisement saying this is the best one you can get, and it's going to set the standard, you know, from here on out, etc. Kilburn's saying this is not the standard, this is actually the what? The worst one, okay? So what were some of the faults? Just really quickly here, okay? Genesis 1:21, cod for God. So when the text should say God, it reads what? Cod, okay? In so many places. So still talking about Genesis, chapter 7, verse 3, chapter 10, verse 19, chapter 15, verse 3. Abraham, before God changed his name from what? So they're calling him Abraham before in the text God actually what? Changed his name. So is that a mistake? Yeah. It's obviously a mistake, right? There's a ton more that he goes through. I don't want to read all of these just because it's tedious and it would take a long time to do it. But you guys can go through here and look at some of these. Some of these are just, you know, like ridiculous. We did highlight down that paragraph, let's see here, right here, where he brings up again the Job 4:6 reading. There's a bunch of problems with other girls' faults, just in creating somewhat like nonsense readings that don't make a lot of sense. And so we went over that. If you go to the next paragraph, he's going to address some issues in the Gospels related to problems. Just a couple lines. We'll look at a couple of these. He talks about Luke 6:22 and 7:41, a base squabble and nonsense. In chapter 9, verse 3, he talks about how the text reads loves where it should read loaves. In chapter 16, verse 17, it says title or tittle of the law, or title of the law for tittle. So no tittle of the law, but the text says title. Again, loves for loaves. There's all sorts of misprints and problems with this particular edition. Yet, in the advertisement, come on, is it claiming to be examined, corrected, and amended by the original manuscript copy of the translators? Okay. Let's go to page 4. So in a twist of irony, the very edition claiming to have been examined, corrected, and amended according to the original manuscript copy of the translators was one of the worst editions Kilburn evaluated by Kilburn. Despite their puffery, as Norton calls it, the advertisement was significant in that it sought to leverage public feelings regarding the state of the text to their economic advantage. So what are they trying to accomplish here? Are they aware of the fact that there are issues in the printed text? And are they going to great lengths to try to make the public believe that they fixed all of them? Yeah. Even making refuge to the original manuscript of the translators to do this, right? And so what Norton is saying is the fact that they're leveraging this to their economic advantage demonstrates that was the English reading public aware that the Bible was not being printed very well? You guys understand that point, okay? So let's look at that last sentence again. Despite their puffery, as Norton calls it, the advertisement was significant in that it sought to leverage public feelings regarding the state of the text to their economic advantage, quote. Recognizing public feelings about the state of the text, Field and Hills judged that claims of correctness and authenticity will best promote their commercial ends, and that the notion of settling the text, quote, in an orderly way for the time to come will best preserve their position. So are they leveraging things to try to have things fall to their economic advantage? All right, anybody got any questions or comments about this before we move on?
just a comment that this is operation out of the flesh as opposed to operating out of the spirit. It's obvious.
Yeah, I mean, you got guys who are, you got folks here who are seeking to be profiteers in the, you know, what should be a very meticulously done with great care and concern type of an enterprise, and they're just sort of, they're really, let's just be honest, in a sense, they're lying. They're saying they have the master copy, they're saying they've examined, corrected, and done all the stuff, but when you look at it, they've got the worst one on the market, according to Kilburn, of all the ones that he looked at. Okay? Any other questions? Now, I'm going to say this, and I think that we might have actually found this particular copy online, finally, that Kilburn is evaluating here. Unfortunately, we found it sort of when it's too late, so I couldn't really take screenshots of it and include them in the notes so you guys could see what was going on. But I do believe we have found this particular printing that Kilburn is evaluating by Field and Hills. Okay, look at the next point. Kilburn's other important piece titled Proposals Humbly Presented to Public Consideration, but more particularly The Right Honorable, the Subcommittee of the Parliament for Religion Concerning the Future Printing of Bibles in English. That's the title, okay? Sought to establish a framework for arriving at a standard text. So understand what's going on here. Kilburn publishes two pieces. There's Dangerous Errors that we went through in the last two lessons, and then there's another one, this one about proposals humbly presented, okay? Quote, that there may be a fair copy of the last translation of the Bible engrossed either in parchment or vellum. Okay, so in other words, does he want it on a particular type of paper? In a full character, which may be compared with the original by four or five ministers and so kept in Zion College as an authentic record for orthography, so truly and critically written that hereafter a letter shall not be altered. So what does he want to do?
Immortalize it.
Does he want to establish a standard text that has everything spelled correctly to the letter? This is what he's calling for. Does everybody see that? Okay? And then he says, that so all people upon any doubt may have recourse to the original to prove whether their printed copies vary or not. So what is Kilburn very clearly calling for in proposals humbly presented? He wants to establish a master printing that all printings from then on could be compared to determine if they're correct or not.
Like a proof copy.
Yeah, essentially that's like a proof copy.
We had that when I was working. Yeah, the customer sent you over this, and then when you had the copy come out of the press, they would make sure that all the prices were correct. And
that's pretty much exactly what this is. Professor Norton unpacks these statements from Kilburn as follows, quote, original seems to mean first the translator's manuscript, then new fair copy. And then, in a full character, probably means in a large hand and without abbreviations. Those are his opinions. I don't know if he's right about that. I just included those just for completeness sake. Okay? But it's very clear what he's proposing. He wants to produce a master copy that will be the standard bearer that all the rest are going to be, you know, compared against. That was the first thing. Next, Kilburn proposed, quote, that the Bible hereafter may be printed truly according to the translator's copy, with diverse readings and parallel places in the margin as formerly hath been done. So does he want it to conform to the original standard in terms of marginal notes and cross-references, parallel places, etc., as formerly hath been done, which are helps for the comparing of some and illustration of other places. So, he wants it to be exact in its orthography and spelling, but does he also want it to have the original notes in the margin and cross-references? Okay? that some scholars may be appointed to the correction, who have skill in the original, and not left to mercenary corrections. Now, I take that to be sort of a slam on how they were doing their proofreading. Okay? The Bible was never better printed, than Mr. Buck and Mr. David at where?
Cambridge.
So let's stop there. Amy, you asked a question last week. What is the standard that Kilburn is judging all this by? Remember when we were going through the errors, you raised that question. It's very clearly the standard of whose printings? The Cambridge printings. Okay? All right, any questions before we go to page 5?
Who were the oversight stationers company? Was that established by the king?
The stationers company was, I think I kind of talked about this last time. I would call them sort of like a guild. I wouldn't call them a union the way that we would modernly understand a union, but they were a guild, like a printer's guild, that had certain standards and so forth for what they were accepting as quality work.
Okay.
And I think they were also keeping track to some degree of like registered printing rights, copyrights, stuff like this. Similar in that way, maybe to our Library of Congress kind of a concept. I'm not totally sure all the details of everything that they did, but they did have some sort of oversight as far as print standards go. Anybody else?
For the obvious printer errors, were they not corrected, or were they just observed and left, or why weren't they corrected?
Well, I mean, I guess it depends on how you want to look at it, right?
Yeah.
So, let's take this one that Kilburn, by Field and Hills, that Kilburn has issues with, says it's the worst one that he looked at, the one that's related to this advertisement, right?
Okay.
Kilburn says there's 20,000 of them that have been printed.
Okay, so they had 20,000 printing that they didn't really...
So, like, that's just out in the ether now.
Right.
So, I don't think Field and Hills are not like calling those back in to correct them.
No.
They're just sort of...
But the next set of 20,000 that they print, have they corrected those errors?
Well, first of all, I don't know if they printed another 20,000 or not, but it's an outstanding question. You would think that a reputable printer would want to fix any mistakes that they've made. But if you listen and when you read Kilburn, he seems to think that that's not the motivation. The motivation is money. The motivation is profit, which means you're probably not all that concerned with going back through and meticulously checking to see that you're doing things correctly. You're more interested in getting things done so that you can get those things out there to be sold.
Yeah.
That would be my read of it, Bart.
Yeah.
Anybody else?
So, all these errors are made known, then he's probably not going to have a very good business model after that.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting twist regarding one of these guys, which we'll get to later on. But even when you read Kilburn, he's basically like, well, these 20,000 are basically refused to be sold by reputable sellers, so they're sold in the countryside at what he used a specific term. He said markets and
fairs
and markets, he says, or something to that effect, right? Where was that at?
Flea markets.
Yeah. Yeah, like.
Can you make that again?
Yeah, it's being sold at the places that you guys are going all the time. So yeah, did you have a follow-up there, Mike?
What? No, that's...
Okay. Top page 5. Regarding these quotes from Kilburn, Norton writes, quote, "This is either redundant, or if translator's copy means the same as the original that the ministers are to make comparison with contradictory. The crucial point is that..." So in other words, what Norton's saying is that it's a little unclear exactly what Kilburn means when he uses the term original here. Okay? But then he says in the next line, the crucial point is that he looks for a standard, and while assuming the existence of the translator's original, takes it as unsatisfactory. Point three is that some able scholars may be appointed to manage the correction. They should have skill in the original, now meaning the original languages. It is here that the reference comes to the Bible being, quote, never better printed than in the Cambridge 1638 edition, where indeed able scholars were with skill in the original had supervised the text. Most of these points might have been cribbed, that means copied, from another person's work illicitly or without acknowledgement from Field and Hills, but what matters most is the essentially conservative spirit they embody. Let the editorial work be perfected and enshrined in a standard, thereafter no more what? That's essentially what he wants, right? That is the goal of what Kilburn is wanting here. The recommended procedures never took place, and so for want of anything even better, the 1638 text gained more and more acceptance as the standard, or in the word of dangerous errors, as authentic. So, what Kilburn called for in humble proposals or proposals humbly presented never actually what?
Materialized.
It never actually materialized. So in lieu of it materializing the way Kilburn called for it, what became sort of the de facto standard is the 1638 what? Cambridge Bible. Okay, the one that was done at Cambridge. Kilburn's final point moves from correction of the text to correction of the translation according to Norton. Quote, notwithstanding many faults were amended in the Cambridge edition, partly by the translators themselves, partly by others. So, this is a controversial statement being made by Kilburn because he's saying that some of the translators, most notably Warden Boyce, who served on the 1638 Cambridge project, are correcting, notice what he says, notwithstanding many faults amended in the Cambridge edition, partly by some of the translators themselves. So is he saying that the translators reviewed their work and were correcting things?
They changed them, whether it was substantial or not.
Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting point, at least from Kilburn's point of view. Okay, so let's start that over again. Notwithstanding many faults were amended in the Cambridge edition, partly by some of the translators themselves, partly by others, yet the whole translation may be revised by learned men and public notice given that so others, for all parts, may suggest to the revisers their opinions concerning amendments. So what he's saying there, see, now what Kilburn is saying is he's going beyond just spelling and punctuation and setting the standards in those senses. Now he's saying the whole thing needs to be reviewed or revised for translational what? Potential translational errors or mistakes. Okay? So, despite Kilburn's call, the translation was never, quote, revised by learned men in the 17th century. It never happened. Alright? Professor Norton summarizes the state of the text by the restoration of the monarchy in 1660 as follows, quote, viewing the history of the text to 1660 as a whole, it manifests a battle between commercial and scholarly spirits in which the commercial benefits of being scholarly were occasionally realized. Within the scholarly spirit, two impulses were in tension. One was the impulse to innovate in the endless quest for perfection. The other was the impulse to fix. By the time of the Restoration, the impulse to fix the text was ascendant. Innovation was confined almost entirely to presentation and extra textual matters. So in other words, you had two forces here, according to Norton's analysis, by the time of the restoration of the monarchy in 1660, you have one impulse that is seeking perfection, and then you have another impulse to fix what was already there. The errors and mistakes that had crept into what was already there. Okay? And what he's saying is that if you read that last sentence again, By the time of the restoration, the impulse to fix the text was ascendant, meaning they were going to fix the printer errors, they were going to fix the obvious mistakes, but they were not going to go back and review the whole thing. As far as a translation, you understand what I'm getting at? Okay? And then he ends the line by talking about innovation was confined almost entirely to presentation. That would be things like page layout, fonts, pictures maybe even,
illustrations,
things like that that now they're going to add into the text. Okay? And he ends by saying, and extra textual matters. Okay? All right. Any questions about that before we at least try to get into the next point? So, I think it's fair to say that by 1660, what was recognized as the general standard text?
1638.
The 1638 Cambridge. Okay? So anything that was done to that text was done mostly from the lens of trying to fix any printer errors. There's no like review of the translation compared against the originals happening. And any innovation is going to come through extra textual things as Norton has just mentioned. Okay? Now, are there any questions before we go on to the next point? No? Alright. So, the state of the text in 1660. Professor Norton addresses the printed history of the text through 1660 in a narrative section of his other book, The King James Bible, A Short History from Tyndale to Today, that is worth considering as a summary. Please note that I have inserted screenshots documenting Norton's various points where possible. So what I've done is I've taken this text out of Norton's book, and I've inserted screenshots of where we can show actual documentation that Norton is referring to. Okay, so I've sort of, in a way, annotated them or enhanced them by providing the photographs of certain things that I'm able to provide for you to look at. So, the declining standard had much to do with the monopoly system that controlled printing. As Sparks showed in 1641, high prices accompanied the low quality. We've already talked about that in a previous lesson. Church Bibles had gone from £1.10 to £2. What became the commonest format, octavo, went from 3 shillings, 2 denarius unbound, to 4 shillings, even though the text was cramped into fewer sheets. So to save money, what are they doing? To save money on paper, what are they doing? They're condensing the text into ever smaller what? Printings. They're cramping it in there to get as much as they can. Octavo New Testaments similarly were 1 shilling instead of 10 denarius. Duodecimo Bibles imported from Holland in 1639 were better than the King's printers of the same year, and at 2 shillings each unbound were half the price. So remember we talked about that, how these printers on the continent were seeking to take advantage of the market and underselling the King's printer. Remember we discussed that in a previous lesson, okay? Pity the manufactory should be carried thither by dear selling here. So in other words, are people going to buy what they think is their best option?
Best value,
best option, okay. Only once was the London price cheaper. The Cambridge edition of 1629 on cost, 10 shillings unbound, was immediately undersold by a quarto from the King's printer for 5 shillings. So here's the point again. Are these guys in direct competition with each other over the Bible market, and are they trying to undersell each other? Okay. Whether or not Kilburn was right, that £10,000 a year could be made, the monopoly was scarcely protected and coveted. In 1642, during the Civil War, the office of the King's printer lapsed. So, we haven't really talked, we've made reference to this, but we haven't talked about it specifically yet. So when the Civil War comes in 1642, the King's printer's office lapses because the crown is no longer what? They're no longer in charge. Okay, so the office of the king's printer lapsed, notice, and other printers entered the market. Also in 1642, the King James Bibles with the Geneva, Thompson, Junius annotations began to be printed. So that again is this edition right here. I've showed you this once before. Notice that this is the Holy Bible, newly translated out of the original tongues. And then it says, with most profitable annotations upon all the hard places. So what this is a King James Bible with the Geneva marginal notes in the margin. And notice this is coming from where? Where did I see that? Is that on there? Yeah, at the bottom, sorry. This is being printed where?
Amsterdam.
In Amsterdam. Okay, so this is a King James Bible with Geneva marginal notes that are now going to be printed in Amsterdam and brought into England. Okay, bottom of page 6. The 1642 title page from the New Testament states that the notes were placed in due order by J.C. I don't think that's Jesus Christ, okay? Probably John Crane, a leading Brownist, who from 1647 proved a different set of annotations to the King James Bible consisting largely of cross-references, which eventually contributed substantially to the King James Bible margin cross-references. So stop right there. Are these printers now innovating by adding things to the margins and changing the marginal notes? Does everybody see that? So that's why Kilburn is calling them to reinstate the original one, marginalia. Is everybody following that? Okay. Page 7. Here's a picture of that title page. So, again, you can see newly translated, okay, with brief summaries and expositions of Theodore Beza upon hard places. Talks about Junius upon the revelation of St. John. And then at the bottom here, it talks about how these are placed in order by J.C. Okay, so again, it's also saying this is coming from where? Amsterdam. Okay, so look at the next statement. The company of stationers began printing Bibles, and William Bentley, with the authority of Parliament, produced octavo editions without the Apocrypha in 1646, 1648, and 1651. Look at the next page. So here's the title page, okay? The Holy Bible containing Old and New Testaments. Late translated of the original tongues by His Majesty's special command. And then look down here. This is done at London by William Bentley in what year? 1646. Look at the next picture. This is the table of contents. So here you have the books of the Old Testament in their order. And then here you have the books of the New Testament starting right here. And what is missing? The Apocrypha that had been between the Testaments is missing from this 1646 printing. Okay? Now, it's important to note that this is happening during the period of the Commonwealth, when things were starting to get, you know, hairy there, and it has, in my mind, a lot to do with the fact that the Puritans did not like the Apocrypha. Okay? Any questions?
Could it also have been financial motivation?
I'm sure it could be. You save money and paper, etc., if you don't include the Apocrypha. I think that could be. I think politically it might have more to do with the Puritans. Because even this one, Bud, the first one we looked at there, Bud, the King James Bible with the Geneva marginal notes, seems like a very Puritan thing to do, because did the Puritans like the Geneva Bible on account of the marginal notes? Remember, the marginal notes in the Geneva Bible were anti-monarchical, and they fit better the theology and practice of the Puritan faction. Okay, so I would say that a lot of this has more to do with the politics maybe than trying to save money.
Yeah. I have a question. They use the term several times, you know, unbound. So I mean, so like printings over in Amsterdam, they came unbound, so they were just the pages. So then they had to be bound.
Yeah, I that's a great question. I don't know all the details of that, but I would assume that that's what it was. So I don't know.
I can't imagine trying to transport loose pages.
We were talking about Unbound stuff. We were talking about London and Cambridge specifically, not necessarily Amsterdam. So I also find it somewhat difficult to believe that an Amsterdam printer would send Unbound copies across the ocean. I would think they would bind them.
There was because of tariffs or something, and if it was assembled in England, it was cheaper than...
I mean, that could be. That could be. I don't know the answer to that part of your question. Page 9. One of Bentley's editions dated 1646, but probably later, is remarkable. Now look it. Chapter summaries are revised and shortened. So again, is that messing with the ancillary material? Okay? The notes are, after the beginning of Genesis, far fewer and almost completely independent, and the cross-references are greatly expanded and also independent, meaning they're unlike any of the other ones that have been printed. They have independent cross-references. So this makes more sense now, right, when you think back at what Kilburn's calling for. He wants all that stuff to be brought to the standard of Cambridge. Because now you've got Bibles going out that have different cross-references, different chapter summaries, different everything as this is unfolding here, okay? Should say different everything, but they're not identical is the idea. The notes are after the, I already read that, okay, independent cross-references are greatly expanded and also independent. The marginal material commonly expands over a foot of the page, sometimes even between the chapters. It also introduced dates as they are commonly found in King James Bibles after 1701. And here's an example. Genesis is before Christ, and they date the year at 4004. Which I... This is the beginning of that type of dating. Okay? In 1648, John Field, so we're talking about Field again here, who was a dominant figure in Bible printing industry for 20 years, issued his first Bible, as seen earlier, and then he references page 109. So I've indented this, and we're going to jump back to page 109 where he talked about Field. Page 108, entering a discussion of what became of the original manuscript given to the printer by the King James translators, a pamphlet of 1651 declares the sole right of printing of the Bible by Matthew Barkers in regard to his father paid for the amendment or correction translation £3,500 by reason whereof the translation copy did of right belong to him. An entry in the stationer's register by Oliver Cromwell allocating Bible printing to the printers Henry Hills and John Field was objected to in 1656 on grounds that the Bible copy was not Barker's, but Bill's, and that it was only held in trust for Bill. And then I got the entry here where you can read the details of that, so I took a screenshot of it. I'm not going to read it all to you, but if you read this, it's a entry into the stationer's log about the dispute over who has the real, you know, rights, if you will, okay? Baker, however, is reported in a 1659 pamphlet by mediation of Mr. Marchmont Nedham, sold the several tomes, of K. James's translation to Henry Hill John Field. So here's the entry of how this allegedly passes into the possession of Hills and Field. Then Barker, by mediation of Mr. Marchmont Nedham, sold the several tomes of King James's translation to Henry Hills and John Field printers by supposition, I believe that is, of absolute and private title. So that's a documentation of how they claim to have come into the possession of the master copy. This purchase of the Bible was probably in 1656 and cost Hills and Field £1,200. And then that brings us again back to our advertisement here that we've been talking about. And again, here's the language. The said Field and Hills have a propriety by purchase Visa, the heirs of Robert Barker, which Barker expended many thousand pounds in the charges of the translation, and in lieu thereof had in conferred upon him by King James. And about 3 years ago, the heirs of Barker, upon the receipt of 1,200 pounds from the said fields and hills, did deliver up them the original copy. Okay? So there's documentation of all this stuff supposedly going down in the possession and changing over of these things. Okay? So later in 1656, a new edition of the Bible by Field and Hills was advertised in Nedham's Mercurius Politicus as being examined, corrected, and amended according to the original manuscripts of the translators. I'm going to skip that next screenshot and go to the next bit of text. This was advertising as we are used to it, Norton says. So in other words, this could be total garbage just to get somebody to what? Buy it. Okay? This is advertising as we are used to it. The value to Field and Hills of the Bible copy was the legitimacy it gave them as monopoly of the Bible right, copyright. Though we cannot tell which edition is being referred to, none of their editions from this time show any signs of examination, correction, and amendment. Rather, they were notoriously poor, and in the 1659 pamphlet defending them admits to faultiness. Okay? The letter references to the original are all secondhand and of questionable value. William Kilburn refers to Hills and Field, quote, purchasing the translator's copy made in 1611, and he also alludes to, quote, the original in his humble proposals. A pamphlet printed about June 1660 repeats Hills and Field's claim in an attack on them. They have, quote, obtained and now keep in their actual possession the manuscript copy of the late translation of the Bible in English, attested with the hands of the venerable and learned translators in King James's times ever since 6th of March 1655. Now, if you go to page 11, you can see this being highlighted and accented here. Okay? Have not obtained, I noticed, the master copy of the translation of the Bible, the venerable learned and translators in King James's time, and notice right here, 6th March, and thereupon, by color of an unlawful and enforced entrance in the stationer's registry. So, in other words, is there a lot of potential smoke and mirrors and foul play going on in this? Is everybody following that? Okay, let's finish this because we're not going to get done in the time we have left. So I'm going to have to decide what I want to do about that, but I'll worry about that later. So finally, in a lawsuit against Christopher Barker, Roger Norton refers to the quote, how do you say this?
Moiety
of the manuscript of the Bible in English called the Bible of King James's translation, perhaps that partial or half manuscript, the moiety of the manuscript, is not the same manuscript as that referred to in other references, or perhaps is a variation on the report of several tomes, not impossibly it could refer to about 1602 or another volume of a similar sort. Speculation that the manuscript was lost in the Great Fire of London, 1666, may be right, but there may be new discoveries waiting to be made. So it is generally understood that even if these guys had the original manuscript, even if they had it, that it was burnt and destroyed in the Great Fire of London in 1660. And then Norton goes on and he says, whatever the final manuscript was, there is no clear evidence that it was ever used for print after the first edition had been printed. So what does that mean? That means there's no evidence to suggest that anyone ever corrected or amended anything with the text off of this original manuscript after the 1611 original printing was done. That's what he's saying. So let me read that again. Whatever the final manuscript was, there is no clear evidence that it was ever used for print after the first edition had been printed. It may have been referred to, but subsequent editions were made, and with an increasing degree of randomness from earlier editions, not from the manuscript. So in other words, as they sat, so when Cambridge set to make the 1638, were they revising their 1629? That was their basis. They did not go back to whatever this original manuscript was. Does that make sense? Okay. Now, unfortunately, that's all the time we have. Even if I had started on time, we wouldn't have time to get through the rest of this. So I'm going to have to give some thought as to what I want to do with this material. So let me think on that, and whatever happens, I would bring you guys, you'd have a new copy of the notes for next week. So any questions or comments?
You know, they knew these guys were con guys. Why did they have them arrested?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
I mean, they knew they were doing wrong.
I think that possibly had the Civil War not come, and the king and the crown had remained in control, things might have been different. But that's not what happened. And so when the crown copyright lapsed, things just sort of got thrown in sort of the Wild West situation. And that's when you got anybody printing the text, a lot of these foreign guys coming in, all this stuff starts to happen. Okay? Alright, we do have to quit. It's 10 o'clock. It's 1 minute after. So, I'm going to decide what to do with the rest of this, and then we'll go from there, but you don't need to bring these with you next week, okay? So I appreciate